You're listening to Bob, Dave, and More on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
Well, it's been a while since we've had an opportunity to talk to this guy, but we finally nailed him down, and he is with us on the Zeke's Pizza Hotline. You hear him on the pregame show, halftime show, postgame show of the Seahawks broadcast. Our buddy, Big Ray Roberts. Ray, how are you, man?
I'm hanging in there, Pete. Doing my best to, like, be quarantined and stay busy and being creative with my work and trying not to go crazy. But other than that, I'm doing all right.
Yeah, before we get into the Seahawks and what they've done with the O-line and your take on all of that, what do you got going? I see you posting on Twitter about it looks like you're in a garage or you're working out with the sons and your sons and everything. What's going on? Are you creating new workouts?
Yeah, it seems like it. So my son Price is in ninth grade, and so just trying to get him to stay active and not sitting on the couch playing Madden all day. And so I needed to get myself moving again, too, and so it was a good time to do some father-son bonding. And so we just use the weights that they have in their garage at their house and whatever else we can find to create these workouts. So we try to work out 3 to 4 days a week and just trying to teach him how to work hard and, like, push through the times when your muscles are burning and you feel like you can't do another rep or another set. And we just push through that and get to the next set and just trying to get his mindset right for, really understanding this whole football thing.
Well, all right. Well, let's quickly get into your take. They've added a few names, none of which are household names on this O-line. It seemed like the kid they picked up from Pittsburgh seems to be the one that has the most upside, according to most people here that we've talked to. But what's your impression of the guys they've acquired and who stands out as maybe the biggest or most likely contributor of the bunch?
Well, the thing that I like is that if you look at the four guys, there's a combined 225 games that they've played, and there's 129 starts, and they're all under the age of 30. And so when I look at that, when we were coming into free agency, I thought that the best way for the Seahawks to build their offensive line was to find some veteran guys, some guys that have played and have games under their belt, bring them in and start to build around that kind of young group of dudes, because the learning curve and the ability to gel is a lot faster with these veteran guys versus bringing in a bunch of rookie dudes that are having to learn the NFL, learn the system, learn how to play with all these brand new dudes. And so from that perspective, I like what they've done. I know that some people have said they should have gone after like an all-pro right tackle versus these dudes, but here you get to create some competition. You get to have some depth at some different places. And when I looked at the film, the dude that I think will probably contribute right away is BJ. I think it's Finney. That's how you say it. But to me,
yeah,
he's a bigger, like probably more athletic Joey Hunt. I don't know that he's better than a healthy Justin Britt, but I think he upgrades that position, whether or not he has to play or he's going to back up Britt, or if Britt isn't going to be back, then he can be the starter. There's some things that he does. He's not like a super overpowering dude, but he does kind of anchor the middle of the when he plays, he's anchored the middle of the line where you're able to set the depth of the pocket. He doesn't get pushed back too much. And then in the run game, he doesn't move people a ton individually, but he works well on double teams and gets up to the second level pretty good. So I think that's an upgrade from that perspective. The other dudes the two big offensive tackles that they had, the Cedric, I can't say his last name. I'm going to mess it up if I say it.
Oboihe.
Oboihe. Okay. He and the dude Shell, I think that they have an opportunity to really compete for one of the tackle spots, and for the right tackle spot. And then also either one of those guys have a chance to be the Fant tight end. So the kid, Cedric, is a little bit more athletic, I think he is. He's taller, a little leaner, moves pretty good. Again, he doesn't play with a ton of power and leverage in the run game, but in the pass game, he moves pretty good. And then I like just Shell has, like, really good effort. He's a real He works really hard to finish his blocks and things like that. And so I like what they have in him. The wild card will be this kid, Warmack, with him playing guard and coming back and been out for a little bit. To me, he looks like a smaller version of DJ Fluker, cause he's more of a mauler than he is a technician. But I think they have some dudes that they can put into the rotation with Jamarco Jones and, what's the other kid's name? Phil Haynes. And then, with the rest of the group, I think they've upgraded the overall, like, athleticism of the group. And they have some interchangeable parts. Like, I'm not always a fan of all the interchangeable parts because I'd like people to just major in what they do. But with all the injuries and things that they've had along the offensive line with the starters here, it's a good idea to have some dudes that can play multiple positions.
Hey, Ray, I think you're with me. You're a Britt fan. I think he's really athletic and just a big, strong dude. But getting back to Joey Hunt, can Joey Hunt be the everyday, day-in, day-out starter, or do you still sort of view him as having the talent of more of like a backup?
Yeah, I still just think he's more of a backup because if you're able to scheme to where you get him isolated in pass protection or in the run game, where you can cover like both guards in the center, he's going to have a tough time. And so he's a great effort dude. He's probably a great dude in the locker room. He's probably a great guy at practice. Bit. And so I think he's better suited at being a backup and like coming in and like, you know, he can hold you over for a couple games, but to think that he's going to be your starter for 16 games and he's going to be super productive there and bring something different to the table or more to the table than Britt does or this Finney guy does, I think you're probably, I mean, you're not in your right mind to think that, I don't think.
So do you think, and it feels like they're, sorry, Jim, I didn't mean to jump over you there, but I just wanted to follow on that. Are you of the belief that Britt's going to be gone based on his salary and he's coming off a pretty severe knee injury? I mean, it's hard to figure out his value to this team, and I would think Russell would have a better assessment of that than anybody would. So is it your belief that, all right, all of these acquisitions pretty much lean toward he's going to be out of here?
I don't know. Like it's been, with all the stoppage and work and all that kind of stuff, it's just been kind of hard to figure out what they're thinking about him. I don't know the severity of the knee injury. You know, I know that you can blow your ACL and come back from it. I did it. And so, and today it's a lot easier to do. But I'm like Dave, like I just really feel like when you have two, good guards beside him, it elevates his game. And then he's able to be athletic. He's able to, there's some plays back a couple years ago they had him pulling. He's athletic enough to do that kind of stuff. And he's big enough and strong enough to really, hold down the middle of the offensive line. I like him. I thought that he had elevated his game to being, one of the better centers in the league. Before he got injured, and it was serving him really well to play next to some veteran guards that knew what they were doing. So if I was the Seahawks, without knowing like the severity of the injuries and trying to figure out the cap number and all that kind of stuff, he would be a dude that I'd want to keep just because there's a comfort level with Russell. There's a comfort level with the offense. He's a smart dude. He doesn't seem to make bad calls and get him in bad situations. And they've invested a lot in him. He was a project when he came in and played, I think, both guards. They may even tried him at tackle, and then they put him at center, and then they still had to work with him a little bit to understand his power angles and his leverage and all that kind of stuff. But then once he got it, I think he really excelled at it.
Hey, Ray, which surprised you more, George Fant getting 3 years at $10 million a year, $30 million from the New York Jets, or Fetty only getting a one-year deal for around $1 million from the Bears?
You know what? I'd be honest with you. Like, I think the Fetty deal surprised me the most, even though, it's really hard to believe that George Fant got the deal that he got. Because I love George Fant. I just don't know that he's an everyday starter at left tackle out there by himself. And then, but with Fetty, having 60 starts under his belt. I know he hasn't always played the way folks would expect him to play or would like him to play, and he has his penalties and things like that. But I thought I saw some areas where his game was getting better, and there was still more for him to do better. But at the end of the day, I think it was a good move for Effetti to go somewhere else, to get a fresh start, to get a different set of voices in his ear, to have a chance to kind of clear his brain space to be able to go out and make those things better that he needs to make better. I think his best football is still ahead of him. You know, it's just not here in Seattle. But I was shocked that it was just a bit over the veteran minimum.
And it sounds like they're going to use him at guard, from what I'm reading and hearing from some of my friends out there in Chicago. And if they do that, do you feel like, all right, maybe that was the better spot for him here in Seattle, or is it just based on the O-line coach and their blocking scheme that would make him better at guard versus tackle?
Yeah, well, you know, when they played him at guard here, I thought it was a mistake only because I knew that they were going to eventually put him at tackle. And so, you know, you can – when you look at offensive line, everybody looks like they're doing the same thing. But it is a difference between going from the inside and playing guard and outside playing tackle. There's a lot more space and things like that, and power angles are different, and muscle memory is different, and all that kind of stuff. But if they're going to play him at guard, I just think they probably need to work a lot, like, on his stance. His stance is really wide, which makes it harder to move. And then also – in pass protection, being a tackle, he just naturally likes to turn his shoulders to the sideline. And when you do that at guard, that's a straight line to the quarterback. So if they're going to work on those things about him and correct some of those things about him, then playing him at guard, you can maybe protect some of his weaknesses a little bit, you know, because you have a center on one side and a tackle on the other side. And so that maybe some of those things that maybe get exposed with him being out at tackle, you can limit that a little bit at guard.
Hey, Ray, a double barrel question here. First of all, we had Howard Mudd on, and I'm just wondering, how much you've run across him and what you think of him, because everybody just loved him. And then the other thing is, you know, he said he was very much against the notion that you can get a defensive player out of college and coach him into, you know, an offensive lineman, and he did not buy into that sort of Tom Cable theory at all.
Yeah, so just to be, like, totally transparent, Howard Mudd is my all-time favorite coach. I mean, he was literally, like, the relationship that we had was almost like he had become, like, this father figure in my life, because I've turned to him for a bunch of different things that were even had nothing to do with football. Before I retired, he was the first person I called and was like, hey, like, this is where my brain is. This is where my mindset is. What do you think? And so I talked it through with him the night before I called the Matt Millen and Marty Marniwag and told him I was retiring. I talked to Howard. And so I talked to Howard quite a bit. We were just on the phone probably about a month ago, and we probably talked for a couple hours. I would go visit him over in Kirkland. But I would agree, like, there are few people that you can bring from basketball or – to play defense and bring them over to play offense. And they may be able to look the part, like they may be able to kick step and slide out and get in front of people and all that kind of stuff. But it's like the little bitty things that you just learn from playing years and years and years at that position. And it's just like that at every position. So, you know, at linebacker, there's like just little things that you just learn from playing it over and over and over and over. That isn't in the playbook. It's not going to be something that the coach teaches you. It's just going to be something that you learn from the experience of playing. And so you don't get that when you just go from defense to offense or basketball player to offensive line. There's so many little things you just learn just from playing the game a lot that you don't necessarily, you don't get to learn and master when you're just coming in like that. And so I would have to say, yeah, there will be some exceptions to the rule, but I would tend to agree with Howard. And it's hard for me to find anything to disagree with Howard on, because the dude just meant so much to me in my career, and I think so much about him.
Well, we sure enjoyed talking to him last Friday. He sounded like a great guy and a great coach. Ray, what I'm wondering about, now we talk about these guys, and they're basically backups, or like in Phillip Payne's case, he's only a second-year player and had injury concerns last year. But out of Phil Haynes, Ethan Posick, and Jamarco Jones, out of those three guys, which one has the best chance of popping and becoming a starter? And it always seems like Posick is at the tail end of most of those lists.
Yeah, when Posick first came in, like, I was super impressed by him. Like, he was more of a technique dude than he was a power guy. And I thought that he was at someday would take over at center because he's smart, he was athletic. But for whatever reason, it just didn't pan out, and it doesn't seem to be like he's always at the top of the list of the plans. But out of those three dudes, man, I really think Jamarco Jones, once they settle him in wherever they're going to play him, I think he has a real chance at not just being good, but being very good, because he has good footwork. He's just a good football player, and I think you can plug him in anywhere. But if they use him as like this utility guy, he's never going to be great at one thing. And I think if they put him in, either play him at guard or play him at tackle, but wherever you're going to play him, just put him there and let him grow there. And I think that out of those three guys, he has the biggest upside. And then I would say Phil Haynes, and then Ethan Posick.
Well, Ray, you watch this team as closely as anybody, so let me ask you about what they've done on the defensive side of things. Nothing happening with Clowney to this point, but they bring back a couple of former Seahawks and Bruce Irvin and Benson Mayoa. I mean, we were sort of throwing out the hypothetical, what if they're done? What if they just move on and say, hey, we feel good about what we've done so far. We think we're going to be better. In fact, Jim was willing to bet the farm on the fact that they'd have more sacks with the group that they currently have than they did last year with Clowney there. What do you think? Do you feel like, all right, they still need to add to this, or you're happy with the additions? How would you sort of size up what they've done defensively so far?
Well, I'm pleased with what they have, with the guys they've signed on defense. They're dudes that have proven that they can get to the quarterback, and they're starting to have enough dudes where they can send guys in waves, and people aren't getting tired and worn down throughout the game. And so I think that would be an advantage to them. And I just think just naturally they're going to have more sacks than they did last year, even if they didn't sign any of these dudes and Clowney didn't come back. You're going to end up with more sacks than they had last year. I think that was just an anomaly for whatever reason. But I think to really, like, put the defense in a position where they can have a chance to be close to dominant or close to being like a Super Bowl contender, I think you have to have Clowney anchoring all of that. Because even with his lack of sack numbers last year, he was still rated really high as a defensive end. He was like probably, I think they at one point, the most double-teamed player defensive end in the league. And so if you think about bringing in these other guys and get after the quarterback, well, then maybe there's more opportunities for him to be singled up, and then there's more opportunities for him to have sacks or pressures or what have you. But when nobody else is getting to the quarterback, it's really easy to shut down the one dude by double-teaming. If you think about the year before when Frank Clark was here, and he got hot, and then they started double-teaming him, then all of a sudden Jaren Reed got hot, you know? And so if you think that Jaren Reed's sack totals were not connected to the attention that Frank Clark was getting, then you're just kind of crazy. Like, Jaren Reed just didn't all of a sudden become a beast of a pass rusher, but he was good enough that when he was singled up, he could win when Frank was being doubled up. And so I think what they've done I like, but I still think that you need to have Clowney to kind of seal the deal on that front seven.
Hey, Ray, a tough question here, and I think Chris Carson is a special player, and I feel like if he'd have been healthy, they would have won that playoff game against Green Bay, and then who knows if they're able to make it past the Niners. But what do you do with running backs these days? Because, I mean, and let's say that Chris Carson has a similar year to the last 2 years where he gets, 1,150, 1,230 yards. Do you pay him? Do you give him a big contract? Because running backs, man, the market is just soft for them, and rightfully so, just because they get hurt. But what would you do if Chris Carson played in every game, had 1,400 yards? What do you do with a guy like that?
Yeah, it's the thing that's hard is that Chris Carson has become a victim of his own success, right? Because he's proof that you can find a running back in the fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh round, and they can be a 1,000-yard rusher. And so then the incentive to pay a dude like that, especially one that's been injured and stuff, is lessened, because you can be like, we'll find another Chris Carson, you know what I'm saying, in the later rounds. And so he's been a victim of his own success there. However, I love Chris Carson. I freaking love him to death. At this point, though, like with the way that the money's going with running backs and the way running backs are popping up out of, you know, dime a dozen nowadays that are very productive, it'd be really hard to kind of invest really deeply in him, you know. So I'm not real sure, like, you know, what his contract status is or when he's up again or what number he's looking for, whatever. But I think the Seahawks have to proceed with caution around that position because they just had too many dudes that are that get hurt and don't finish the season, and then all of a sudden you're going to be tied up with money in them. I think I like the idea of what they're doing with the pass rushers, maybe stockpile a couple running backs and then maybe do some load management with Chris so that he can not take as many hits and last the full season but still be the dude that sets the tempo for the physicality of the offense.
Ray, what do you think their strategy should be in the draft for getting offensive linemen? You talked about, boy, the season kind of being on hold and how you're going to be missing all these different mini camps and OTAs. You think they should just pick and choose or have a little bit different strategy or just business as usual when it comes to picking players?
Well, you're saying just picking offensive linemen, Jim, or just picking in general?
Yeah. Yeah, offensive linemen.
Yeah, so there's a lot of really good offensive linemen in this draft. There's some dudes that just were like off the charts at the combines, and so there's always that, you know, that's going to trickle down to some other dudes that are really, really good but maybe didn't like show as well at the combines. So you know, I think they have to watch a lot of film. They have to be trustworthy of the people that coached them before, you know, in college, and then be trusting of their scouts. But I don't know. I still, with this draft, I still think, you know, in that second or third round, you can, or even fourth round, you can still find some quality linemen that can end up being starters for you. And that's at guard and at tackle. There's just some good football players on the line in the draft this year. And it's not as top heavy as it can be sometimes. But there's some very good second or third day players that can end up being starters in the league. And so I would proceed with it that way. And like with that first round draft pick, really try to find a player at that number that is going to come in and contribute like right away, that can really add something to the game. I think if you draft a lineman at that point, that I don't know that he would be as big a contributor right away, even though you'd probably be forced to play him. Just too much to learn. The team is at a place where it's really close to being real Super Bowl contenders, and to try to break in a rookie offensive lineman right off the bat, I think would be difficult versus having some other guys that can add to the depth that you already have, and you have a chance to develop them over the next, you know, couple years, and then they have a chance of being real players and real starters.
He is Big Ray Roberts. In fact, that's his Twitter handle. You can follow him on Twitter at Big Ray Roberts. Ray, always good to talk to you, my friend. Thanks so much for the time. Stay safe, stay well out there, and we'll hopefully be talking soon.
Yes, sir. Thanks for the patience, too. It just took me a while to get, you know, settled in with all this other stuff I do, you know, working from home, to kind of get time to look at the film and find the film. And so I was finally able to do that. Didn't want to let my man Dave Wyman down. And
yeah, you're the man, Ray.
Yeah, when Dave calls, I just get it done.
Appreciate you.
We appreciate it, man.
All right, brother.
There you go.
Thanks, Ray.
There he is, Big Ray Roberts. By the way, the 5 o'clock refresh is brought to you by Frost Brewed Coors Light, made to chill. Coming up, is Pete Carroll too loyal when it comes to his coaching staff? We talked about this briefly. We talked about it with Paul Moyer. We'll get deeper into this conversation next with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
A reminder that you can listen to our show via the 710 Sports app. It's powered by Dubin Law Group. Well, we asked the question before. We brought this up before when we were speaking with Paul Moyer last week. And the question is Pete Carroll too loyal when it comes to his coaching staff? Now, he's got two coaches, or had one, that's gone in Daryl Bevel. He's got Ken Norton Jr. And both are viewed the same way by a segment of the Seattle Seahawks fan base, and that is that they're inept, they don't know football, They don't know what they're doing. Yet Pete Carroll is blind to all of that because he's just so loyal to guys he just really thinks are good guys. So he's going to suffer with their lack of knowledge in order to maintain that friendship. Dave, does that seem realistic to you?
No, no, it doesn't. I mean, look, Pete is a very nice guy. We all know that. You know, we get that every press conference. It's very rare that Pete gets, you know, snippy with anybody, or he's just, you know, he's a much more professional than Bill Belichick. But don't be mistaken. Pete is still, I would say, I think he's more of an old school coach than everybody thinks. So he's not gonna just keep a guy on because he's buddies with him or he's friends. And everybody knows that's what you know, what this business is about, is that you have to be able to, you know, be entirely objective when it comes to whether the guy's your friend or not. And so, and you know, in case I don't get a chance to come back on this before we go to break, you know, to me, Pete is very involved in the defense. And we've said this a million times, that that's Pete Carroll's defense. So whatever was called, I get the feeling, and I'm pretty sure, whatever the defenses that were called during the game and everything, he signed off on. You know, and I think him and Ken probably sit there and look at the game plan. They look at the personnel. What can we do? What can't we do? You know, these are the calls that we're going to make. And unless Ken Norton was straying from that game plan and not doing what Pete and he agreed to do, then, you know, I feel like it's pretty much as much on Pete as it is on Ken Norton. So to me, I don't think that that's the case, and I just don't think he's that kind of guy either. I mean, you hear every once in a while he'll tell it like it is, but I just think everybody gets the feeling that he's this new age coach that's nice and won't yell at anybody or hold anybody responsible, and I just don't think that that's the case.
Yeah, well, I'm still kind of confused about Ken Norton, though, and I suppose you're right, Dave, that Pete Carroll, it's his defense, and yet you do have a defensive coordinator, so I don't know what the relationship is there. I just look at the numbers, and whoever's in charge of that defense, whether it's Pete Carroll or Ken Norton, something needs to be changed, because we've talked about it over and over again, about all the individual players that we seem to like on the defense, and yet collectively they're not good. And I just...
Should Pete fire himself? Norton, and I...
Well, maybe, or bench himself for a few games anyway, or something. But I just have in front of me right now, I went back, I wrote a post a couple months ago wondering if the best offseason change the Seahawks could make is getting rid of Ken Norton, instead of, we sit there and talk about, boy, they got to get Clowney back, they got to get a pass rush, they got to do this, they got to do that. Well, I think if they replace Ken Norton, that might solve a lot of their problems. And I'm not just talking about Seattle. I'm looking at Seattle's numbers. They've declined in the 2 years that he's been here. And just as an example, in 2017, they were 11th in defense yards allowed. In 2018, they were 16th in yards allowed, so they went down five spots there. This last year, they were 26th in yards allowed, going down 10 more spots. And not only that, and this is the most telling one to me, second most yards allowed in franchise history. The franchise started in 1976. And so, you know, I don't know if it's personnel or if it's schemes or coaching or what it is, but he wasn't much better in Oakland. You look at the Raiders when he was there as defensive coordinator, 22nd in 2015, 26th in 2016, 23rd in 2017. So they were basically, what, running in space there, treading water, basically. So, I don't get it. I mean, you guys know more about football than I do, but I'm just looking at the numbers and how terrible that defense was all year long, and I don't get – like, I understood why Daryl Bevel got a pass, you know, for all the people that complained about what he called in the Super Bowl. Shouldn't have thrown it. We've gone over that a million different times. But the man did win a Super Bowl calling plays. Ken Norton, I'm not sure what he's done to justify getting a third year here in Seattle.
Well, we had Paul Moyer on last week, and we asked him this question about, you know, is it Norton? Was it the scheme? Cut number five. Here's what Paul Moyer thinks of what's happened. All right, we don't have cut number five. basically, let me summarize. He said they ran a different defensive scheme last year, whether they want to admit it or not. They need to get back to being more physical. And I know, Dave, that's something you've talked about, is just the physicality, which on the surface seems simple, but there's also that level of trust in a lot of young guys out there that maybe you just can't afford to get that physical. You can't afford to play up on guys. You've got to give them that cushion because you didn't really trust what you had behind everybody. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, and I think that Jim's questions are totally fair, you know, because it does come down to the coaching. So, but I just felt like for whatever reason, and that's the part that mystifies me the most, maybe, is that they didn't, you know, get young guys enough reps and that they didn't trust those guys. So, and you know, look, they're looking at things differently than we are. I just didn't see. I mean, I remember in the preseason game, Marquise Blair totally ditched his coverage and came up and got a quarterback hit. And, you know, that's preseason. I get it. But I didn't see anything worse than Tedrick Thompson when he was in there, or Lano Hill. So I don't know what went on there. That's another weird part of it. You know, we talk about C.J. Collier. What did he have, 165 snaps or something? It just wasn't enough for him. So, I mean, you're usually, if you're playing 100%, there's probably 60, 65, maybe 70 plays a game. And, you know, he didn't even really get three whole games a chance out there. So there's a lot going on that was just different this year. But again, I think it's fair for Jim to have that question. I don't know that that's the answer, firing him. And I feel like if they were going to do that, they would have done that already. So it'll be interesting to see what happens this year. And if they're able to, you know, like when we talk to the linemen, they say, well, they never turned us loose. But yeah, I mean, that indicates to me that they didn't want to take any chances. They wanted to keep everything in front of them. And that you're also coaching based on your offense and, you know, what they can handle. It's not just defense. It's the overall. And the way that they did it ended up winning them 12 games. So, you know, but we'll see what happens this next year. And, you know, with Bevel, I mean, supposedly the worst call in Super Bowl history. That was the 14 season. He was here 15, 16, and 17. So, you know, maybe it does take Pete a while. But again, you know, it's just like the draft. You go, well, how have they done? They've done well. And again, you know, you were a coach on a team that won 12 games. You know, the defensive numbers were not good. But, you know, you still, it's not like it was just so bad that it killed the team. It didn't kill the team.
All right, coming up, a guy that Jim believes made a really bad defense much, much better. That'd be safety Quandre Diggs. He joined the morning show. We're going to hear what he had to say. He answers the question, is he the most important player on this defense? That's coming up with Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
It is Bob, Dave, and Moore here on 710 ESPN Seattle. Well, a guy that Jim has said is the most important player on the defensive side of the ball, Quandre Diggs, was a guest of the morning show today. He had a few different things to talk about. He said he's checking in on younger players like Marquise Blair and Ugo Amadi because it's tough. It's their first offseason. They don't really know what to do at this point. So cut number six, Quandre talking about what he's doing with them.
Right now, we're at the point where it's more just, you know, you texting guys. You know, you're just checking on guys, seeing how guys are. You know, I try to check in on the young bucks like Keith and Ugo, you know, just to make sure, you know, because it's their first offseason. So for them, you know, they don't really know, you know, what to expect. And, you know, so I just check on those guys, make sure those guys good. You know that everybody else are veterans with B-Mac and, you know, Shaq and Trey. And, you know, those guys going to work their tail off regardless. But you just check on the young bucks, make sure everything is good with them. You know, extended first off season for them, which is unusual. You know, we'll be getting ready to go back in the next 2 or 3 weeks. So you just check, make sure those guys are working, which I know they are.
So good to see a guy who played a handful of games with his team. He's not a veteran of this team. He's a veteran of the league. But just taking that initiative, and Dave, you at one point were a young guy in the league. I would imagine having a vet check in on you and sort of guide you, especially in a situation like this, it would be invaluable.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and I think it's probably surprising to these guys because you think, well, you're going to come in as a rookie and probably get hazed a little bit. And then, you know, mostly those guys are fighting for a job. And here he is checking in with fellow safeties. So it's really cool. And he's one of those guys that's a leader. And that's the reason why they identified him in the trade. Because when he got traded for, I don't know about you guys, I was like, who? I'd not heard of Quandre Diggs, and I know I'd prepped for him the year before in 18 because we went out and played the Lions where he came from. But, that's part of his deal. And I'm here just shuffling through all these papers. I had written down at one point, like, all of the turnovers and the sacks, and they coincided, a lot of them, with him playing. When he was in, lots of things happened. I mean, they got lots of stats, lots of turnovers, and, or I should say, takeaways and sacks as well. So, yeah, he may be the most most interesting. He might be the most important guy on that. At least he was last year. He seemed to for a while there, anyway.
Well, yeah, I think if I remember right, Dave, as soon as he took over for Tedrick Thompson or Lano Hill or whichever player it was, that the team had something like 15 takeaways in the next six games. And yeah. So it was a marked improvement once he got out there. And I remember Bradley McDougal saying that he felt so much more comfortable. And so McDougal was able to do his job more effectively. And yeah, that's kind of why I was saying most important player. I mean, most of us would be looking at, well, what about Clowney? What about Bobby Wagner? Well, without Diggs in that defense, as bad as they were, they would have been even worse.
Cut number seven, Diggs talking about just being excited to be with the team for a full season this year after coming over late last season.
I remember I told my girlfriend this when I got home in January, and then this might have been like February. We were actually talking on it. And I was just telling her, you know, it's like it's going to be cool to actually, you know, put an off season together with the guys on the team, you know, because when I came in mid-season, it was just like you're throwing into the fire, which is totally fine with me, you know what I mean? But, you know, being able to train and be able to prepare my mind to go into that atmosphere and just that environment just to have fun and play ball, you know, is dope.
Yeah, I can't imagine what a full – and now we'll see what the offseason truly ends up being. But just having a full season with his team after, as he said, getting thrown into the fire, he produced very well, had to deal with injury while he was here, so it wasn't, you know, smooth sailing the entire time. But I can't imagine what a full – training camp, if you have that luxury, and then an entire season with this team would look like for him.
Yeah, he's one of those guys that's like a coach on the field. Kind of reminds me of Moyer, you know, Paul, because I worked a lot with him, and you get players like that really understand it. And you had it with Cam and Earl. I mean, those two guys now, I think somebody told us, I think it was McDougal, that a lot of times he couldn't understand what Earl was talking about, but that was just because Earl's a little weird, but Cam was definitely, you know, one of those guys, and your safeties are very important. And when you look at the difference between the 2013 season and this last season, if you look, for me, I look at it, the position group is safety that is the biggest difference. So, you know, if they can get that part of their defense worked out, those guys are the communicators, man. Those are the guys that are up talking to the linebackers, talking to the D-line, you know, making sure everybody's covered. And like I said, it just looked like they were always in control and never sort of panicked when he was in the game. So it's great to have a guy like that. And remember this, too. Everybody in Detroit was pissed that he was gone. I mean, he had some very loyal teammates there. And then here, I mean, his best friend is Tyler Lockett. I mean, you can't go wrong with a guy like that as far as fitting in to this, to the chemistry on this team.
Plus, you guys know one big reason why he's so happy, don't you?
Why?
What?
Because he got away from that slob of a head coach that he had in Detroit.
Yeah.
That's why.
Hey, I've heard bad things about him, man.
Yeah, yeah. I would imagine there's some relief in that, certainly. Cut number eight, he likes the acquisition of Quentin Dunbar.
You know, I like Hugh's game. He's a former receiver, so you know he sees the game a different way. You know, he sees it a way, you know, through the offensive lens, which is really dope. So I've heard a lot of great things about him. He's actually teammates with one of my good friends, Landon Collins, and Landon spoke very highly of him. So, you know, I'm just excited you know, to welcome into the welcome him into the room, and you know, we're gonna have some fun when you know it's that time to play.
Yeah, I think we're all excited to see what Quentin Dunbar can do out here. It feels like, just based on his numbers and what's being said about him, feels like an upgrade. You know, with all due respect to Trey Flowers, at minimum, he's going to push Trey Flowers, and Trey can learn from him. But a welcome addition.
Yeah, you know, and people have texted in about this. If you want your best players on the field, let's say Trey plays inside or plays maybe a little bit of safety. I mean, that's what he was at Oklahoma State. But either way, you've just got a level of competition. It just raised the bar a ton. And the thing we heard about Dunbar is that he's a studier. And we talked to the guy from ESPN out there in Washington. And, you know, so yeah, he kind of has to be, being a receiver in college. And that's going to give him, like Quandre said there, a little bit more sort of insight into what's going on the other side of the ball. I also really like that the players are now using the term dope. That that's something that maybe went around, and it's coming back around now from the 90s.
Yeah, one more cut from him. I'm curious what he said here. I just saw the title, but cut number 9 from Diggs says, dumbbells are sold out everywhere.
Everywhere. I ordered my dumbbells about 3 weeks ago from Power Block, and I freaking got my kettlebell attachment. I got my bench from them, but the dumbbells, they were just like, oh, you know, we kind of backed up with all the orders, so, you know, it'll be another 2 to 4 weeks. I'm just like, well, I ain't got nothing but time to wait, so might as well just wait to get them.
See, Dave, you're lucky you've got that setup already established at your home. I was in the same spot. I was going from sporting goods store to sporting goods store, couldn't find them anywhere. And then Brock's guy, Brian, out there at Precor Home Fitness in Bellevue, was able to hook me up with some, because everybody's trying to keep a workout going. You can't go to a gym. So I had to be like Dave and buy some dumbbells and bring them home. And luckily I had somebody that had some in stock at the time.
That's how you get strong, man. I mean, you know, the machines are one thing, and then you go to, like, the barbell, that's another. But when you're doing, whether it's bench or incline press or anything, dumbbells, man, that's how I got the strongest when I was in the NFL. And somebody told me that and passed it on, so good for him. Hopefully he's being able to stay in shape, and it's going to be a challenge for these players in the offseason. But, you know, like I've been saying about this whole thing just in general, whoever comes out of this thing better and bettered themselves and made the most of it's going to be ahead.
Yep. All right. Coming up, we'll talk more football. The Professor John Clayton will be with us next. It's Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Wow. You sure know a lot of stuff.
It's great to learn.
Because knowledge is power.
That's why this is such a powerful show, because there's so much knowledge being displayed here each and every day with Bob, Dave, and Moore. We bring in really smart people to educate us even further, and today was no different. What did we learn today, Matt?
Well, first we learned that Jim thinks blue Solo cups are alcoholic camouflage.
The beauty of those red Solo cups, Jim, is nobody ever suspects there's anything but water or a soft drink in there.
Yeah,
I thought it was cheating. I bought blue ones one time, and I thought maybe no one will notice the difference.
Yeah, that's
Jim. You're just underestimating people, I think.
Is it just a given if you have a Solo cup in your hand that you're up to something?
Well, especially if it's red.
Yeah, I generally assume it's an alcoholic beverage of some sort in there.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, I remember.
If you're trying to get away with it, it would be better if you just drank straight from the bottle rather than putting it in the cup.
Yeah. My first year coaching, our best player by far, and he was just a leader and everything. Somehow there was a picture of him at a party, and he had a red Solo cup in his hand. And so I think he had to serve like a 1-game suspension. And I was like, oh, what are you doing holding the red Solo cup, man? You're better off just with a clear glass or something. You could say it's apple juice or something. Jeez.
The cup was the giveaway.
Yeah.
By the way,
it's
how
funny,
are
though.
those Jim, are those 16 ounce or what do those hold? Is that
they hold 16 ounces. Yeah. No, it's kind of funny though, because I remember at first when my kids were playing Little League Baseball, I was like, oh man, I'm not going to have a beer at Little League games. But then when they got to be 13, 14, 15, you start looking around at other parents and, you know, they're bringing coolers and, you know, they're not just bringing water and Diet Coke. And but you still sit there and you try and, you know, kind of hide it a little bit with your solo cups. Just kind of the way it is.
I remember my favorite sport for any of the kids' sports was when Kendall played indoor soccer. There's a place over in Redmond that actually has like a bar. They sell beer. And then it's like kind of watching soccer on like a hockey rink. And then my daughter was super physical. She would check girls into the boards and stuff. And I'm there with a beer in my hand. It was just awesome. Loved that. But it was legal there.
Proud.
Everywhere else. Yeah. You just had to, you know, hide it in like a coffee cup or something like that just to get you through it.
I just pictured Dave just, yes, Kendall, just absolutely eviscerating girls into the boards. And Dave's just fired up with a red solo cup in his hand.
Very proud.
What else did we learn, Matt?
Well, we learned what spark training is.
When he was with the Rockies used to do that spark testing, which a lot of NFL draft dorks, you know, go crazy over it, speed, agility, and all this other stuff. You know, I'm sure the stuff that Wyman hates, you know, the cone drill and all these other things.
Do you hate that stuff, Dave?
No, not too much. I mean, some of it is kind of silly, but I liked Divish's stories about, like, the one about Mike Zunino was awesome. That he was talking about, they called him Warren, and if anybody hasn't seen that movie, and he explained it, but something about Mary, where she has a brother that has the earmuffs on, and if anybody touches the earmuff, then he just went crazy, and that's that kind of sounded like Zunino had a little bit of that in him. I always liked that guy. He's such a sweetheart of a guy, but oh man, you hear these stories about how he just would destroy. I think that bat rack he was talking about was basically in splinters by the time he was done.
Yeah, you still pull for him though, don't you? Even being down in Tampa Bay, I was sorry to see him go, but I'm not sure if it's ever going to work for him hitting wise. Certainly a great defensive catcher though.
Man, he was strong though. You look at, and I know it felt like it didn't happen very often, but when he got a hold of one, he didn't have a cheap home run. There were no wall scrapers with Zunino. Those suckers were no doubters. It was about, all right, let's measure this one. How far did that go? So his home runs were majestic, and they were bombs, but there were just way too many strikeouts in between, unfortunately. So, yeah, but I agree with you, Jim. I still root for the guy. Great guy to talk to. Couldn't be nicer, but, yeah, I'm not sure if he's ever going to find what he's missing up at the plate. What else did we learn, Matt?
Finally, we learned why Jim didn't brag about predicting the Browns' interest in Clowney.
I'm surprised you didn't demand an applause, a round of applause, do a victory lap of some sort in front of John. What happened there?
Well, part of it is the delay, and I didn't want to interrupt anybody. And then part of it is me just being humble.
Humble, right. Jim. Look at that. Look at that.
Well, and just to kind of peel back the curtain, during Ray Roberts' interview in which he said, number one, Clowney is a special player. Number two is that he was double-teamed a lot. And then third was that the low sack total was simply an anomaly. And then Jim texts behind the scenes, texts Bob and I, see, I was right about Clowney. I'm like, none of those things support. They all support exactly opposite of what you said about Jadeveon Clowney.
Well, you guys must have missed something else that he said when he said that he thinks that the Seahawks will get more than 28 sacks next year, even if they don't have Clowney. And it seems to me that I was saying the same thing a half hour earlier. Did you miss that part?
No, well, it just
when he was talking about it being an anomaly.
Yeah.
Well, anomaly, well, anomaly, whatever. I just think, I don't think it was an anomaly. I just don't think they were very good with their pass rush. It's not like we went into the season thinking they were going to be spectacular with the pass rush, was it? I mean,
yeah, I expected better than what we saw, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But
well, they got seven in the Philly playoff game. And I think they got two in the Green Bay game. But, yeah, I mean, it just – I don't know. Sacks have never been a huge part. And they got their bang for their buck because remember when we did sack extravaganza? I don't know if you guys remember that. But, yeah, they got lots of stops, lots of punts, and they made those sacks count anyway. But – that might just be, you know, manipulating the numbers. It's got to be better than 28. And I think it will, no matter who they have. I mean, it's hard to have that low of a total. My gosh. If you look, like I said, in Seahawk history, I think there's once or twice where they had 26 or 27. But they've never, you know, how many years are we going on now with this franchise? Up to 45 or something now. I mean, yeah, it's hard to have that few of sacks.
All right, is that it, Matt?
That's it.
All right, that does it for us. I want to thank our guests today, Ryan Divish, John Clayton, and Big Ray Roberts for joining us on the program. If you missed any of today's show, just head to the podcast page, 710sports.com, click the podcast button, and then just click on our picture. Everything you missed each and every day is waiting for you right there. We appreciate everybody hanging with us and creating a four-hour diversion every single day. Join us tomorrow right here with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.